Okay, this is section two, health, safety and hygiene. Within this section, we're specifically going to be looking at different forms of food poisoning, how it comes about, and all the different things that we can do to minimise risk to customers and make our kitchens as safe as possible. Okay, so food poisoning to start with, the evidence of this is obviously illness to our customers that's caused by contaminated food. And when we're talking about symptoms of illnesses, these are the things that people happen as a result of eating bad food. So, for example, being sick is an obvious one. Diarrhea is another one. Some less common ones are having fever, that means having a high temperature, or a stomach ache. Nausea is often when you feel like being sick, but you haven't actually been sick. Okay, now, typical food poisoning is not particularly harmful. It's going to last for a couple of days. There are some that are a bit more dangerous, but we're not really going to look at those. And in essence, the harmful bacteria that we eat is so small we can't see it, but in essence, folks, it's everywhere, all right? So our job is not to try and kill all the bacteria in the kitchen, but to reduce it to a safe level, all right? Now, in terms of the conditions for growth, we've got food, moisture, warmth, and time, all right? So the food that they want, this comes from high-risk foods, so things like chicken, foods that are unpackaged, uncovered. So these are the kind of things that are going to be attractive to bacteria. They like nice warm conditions. So for example, in the room temperature of a kitchen, they're not going to like it in a fridge or in a freezer. And we'll talk about that later. They like moist conditions. So anywhere there's presence of water, you're going to find lots of bacteria. That's why you don't tend to find problems with dried ingredients. And that's why things like dried pasta, dried rice, flour, they last a lot longer than ingredients like milk and cheese and eggs. All right. The last one, the bacteria needs time. So that's food, moisture, warmth, and time. And ultimately, the last one, the longer that bacteria have to multiply, the more bacteria there will be. All right. And approximately every 20 minutes, if the conditions are right, the bacteria will double. Okay. So all the different things that those bacteria then produce as a result of growing, these are called toxins, and that's basically what makes you ill. Okay, so the causes of food poisoning, all right, so why people get ill in the first place, that's at the bottom of page 14. The number one cause of food poisoning is uncooked food, all right, so food that's raw in the middle, like for example chicken, that's really dangerous. Other sort of typical causes of food poisoning are down to things like poor personal hygiene, so people not washing their hands. Now if you think about the food safety rules and the food hygiene rules, basically, by not meeting those rules, that's when we tend to get our food poisoning. So if we don't reheat until the core temperature is 75 degrees, if we don't store properly, so if our fridge is broken and the food's not below 5, we'll talk about the danger zone later on within the chapter in terms of 5 to 63 degrees. If food is left out in a kitchen, if it's not thawed properly, if we've got dirty equipment, dirty surfaces, all the kinds of unhygienic things that we could do are the kind of things that are going to encourage bacteria to grow. Okay, now, so which foods then are most at risk? When we look at this phrase, high-risk foods, this refers to often foods that are high in protein. These are the kind of foods that bacteria is going to be attracted to the most. So things like your chicken, your eggs, certain fish products, dairy, so soft cream cheeses. Okay, these are the kind of things that are going to go off very, very quickly because they're going to be really attractive for bacteria, and they're going to provide those conditions of growth that we've just been mentioning. So high-risk foods, because they've got lots of protein in them, bacteria will grow rapidly, and this means they've got a short shelf life, so they won't last very long. That's like, for example, milk will only last about a week in a fridge. Okay, so we want to try and use them really quickly, but also make sure that we keep them in the safest and most hygienic of conditions to just guarantee that we're not going to allow the bacteria to come to dangerous levels. Okay, so most high-risk foods as well should be stored in a fridge. That's below 5 degrees Celsius, okay? And that's our high risk. Right at the other end is low risk. These are the things that are very unlikely to cause us food poisoning, all right? And the low-risk ones are the ones that don't meet those conditions of growth. So, for example, the opposite of moisture is something that is dry, okay? So your dry foods, as it says on page 15, things like cereals, crackers, and bread. Also, though, foods that have got a high pH level that's acidic, the acid level is going to stop the bacteria from growing. So things like fruit and pickles. Okay, so different types of food poisoning. These are ones that you do need to learn. And everything that you've seen so far on page 14 and 15, you need to make a little revision card on to make sure that you're really clear about the key pieces of information. So you need to know about salmonella. Everyone should know that that's from chicken. E. coli that we find in raw meats and raw vegetables. Listeria that comes from soft cheeses. Staphylococcus aureus, now that's quite a difficult one to remember, but this is the one that's that we have within our human bodies, in our noses, underneath our fingernails, in our skin. And Bacillus cereus, which is found within cooked rice. Okay, now the different forms of these bacteria have lots of different symptoms. However, you can't really go wrong if in an exam you put down vomiting or diarrhea to go with most of the food poisoning bacteria as symptoms. Okay, so as I said, if for each of those key topics you create a revision card, that would be a good time. And if you want to stop, press pause now to go over those key areas and make revision cards. Right, now within lots of your different lessons you've had within catering over your course, you'll have learnt loads about hygiene, and obviously you'll have learnt about food, personal and kitchen hygiene. Okay, so in essence, you should know lots of different categorized rules. And a good little revision technique is to write down lots of different rules on pieces of paper and then have three main pieces of paper and put a heading on top of each one, one personal, one food, one kitchen, and then time yourself to see how quickly you can divide all of those different rules between those three categories. And that's a really easy way to remember lots of different hygiene rules and which type of hygiene they associate with. Now, all of these rules are based in and around legal precedents. So basically things that are actually enforced by law. So believe it or not, the temperature checks that we have to do within the classroom, that is a legal requirement. Okay, so the main law that governs the food industry is the Food Safety Act. And the idea behind it is it makes food safe to eat for customers and it ensures that level of safety for them. Because when somebody pays us for food, there is a kind of like a given contract, if you like, that we are providing something for them that is safe to consume. Okay, now the people that enforce the Food Safety Act are environmental health officers. They work for the council. They're sometimes known as food inspectors as well. And we've actually got a DVD on the food inspectors. Okay, and basically the idea behind the environmental health officer is they go around and inspect premises and check that firms are following and sticking to the areas of the Food Safety Act. Now, the Food Safety Act is actually common sense about food hygiene. So if there's a rule that you know of, for example, washing hands after going to the toilet, it's probably in the Food Safety Act. Okay, now when they go in, they're going to actually inspect premises. They're going to be looking at things like the records of temperatures. They're going to inspect the cleanliness levels of different areas of the kitchen. They're also going to look at the employees and the way that they actually work with food, right? So their understanding of how to keep food safe. And they're also going to look at the working practices of the business itself, all right? So the actual specific things that they do around food and around running their premises, okay? Now, the first main thing that an EHO is there to do is to advise and give training to people. Principally, they want to be positive within their role and in essence provide a teaching service to the food industry. And if a company turns around and does exactly what an EHO asks them to do, that is the end of the process in terms of support and monitoring. But the problem can often come about as a result of people actually not doing what they're being advised to do. So in essence, because the advice is actually based on legal statutes, that's basically laws, if people don't do what they're told to do, the end result is that then they can be certain sanctions can be imposed on them. So for example, they can be then given a court order to do something. They can have a fine. Legal action can then be placed on the owners of the establishment. And ultimately, they can be shut down. And if the offence is really bad, then people can go to prison. And now the ultimate mistake, if you like, of students when they are looking at a question like this and they're saying assess the impact of poor food hygiene is that people often go for that kind of worst case scenario. People being shut down, someone getting fired, someone going to prison. That is a very, very long way down the road, all right? So we want to think about the implications and think about it in a logical order. So somebody might get food poisoning as a result of poor food hygiene. This may result in somebody actually then making a complaint. The complaint then might get passed on to a council. The council then might send an EHO to go and visit. The EHO would give advice. If the advice isn't taken on board, then it becomes a legal matter. If the legal implications aren't followed and adhered to, this might result in fines, which then might result in other sanctions, eventually leading to things like the sacking of people, the closure of a business, and potentially somebody going to prison. So it's a long way down the line. So make sure that when you answer a question, you are sequential in the way you approach it and don't just go for the big kind of, oh, the business might get closed down as your first point. Okay. Now, in terms of food premises, what they're looking for, they're looking for them to be clean and hygienic. They're looking for all equipment and facilities to be regularly cleaned and maintained, and that includes the toilets. They're looking for somewhere for staff to wash their hands separately. And the kind of the obvious signs of a place that's not particularly clean will be things like mice droppings, okay, signs of infestation, flies, rats. So these are the kind of the telltale signs of a place that's not particularly hygienic. In terms of employees, and we talk about personal hygiene, you guys need to think about personal hygiene as a top-down approach. So everything from the top of someone's head right the way down to their feet, the way that they dress, the way that they prepare themselves to work in a kitchen, these are all the things that relate to personal hygiene. You can obviously read these at the base of page 16, but at the very start of your course, you should have covered lots about personal hygiene, so you should know this really well. Okay, so on page 17 then, moving on to food hygiene and kitchen hygiene, there's some really important stuff here that you've got to make sure you learn. The actual temperature probe that you can see on the page has got several temperatures on it, and you need to learn all of these, all right? They come up lots and lots within exam questions, either as short format questions, so what is the hot hold temperature? Or sometimes you might want to use them within the evidence of longer questions about food safety and food hygiene. So you've got to learn all of the temperatures off by heart. So I'm just going to go through them really quickly. You've got 75 degrees or higher is the core temperature. That's the middle of, say, for example, a chicken fillet. And that's what we're testing to see that then all of the actual bacteria has been killed, or most. All right. So 75 degrees is what our cooking temperature should be. Once it's cooked and we want to keep it warm until we serve it, it has to be held at 63 or above, okay? And you'll notice on the actual diagram from 63 down to 5, that is known as the danger zone, okay? And if food sits in the danger zone for a long period of time, that's when the bacteria is going to grow really rapidly. And obviously the danger zone is room temperature. So the idea behind it is we want to either keep food in the fridge or we want to keep it held above 63 degrees in a hot hold oven. All right, our optimum temperature is 37 degrees. This is where bacteria is going to grow the quickest. And our lower temperatures, food should be stored in a fridge below 5 degrees. That's 0 to 5. If it's going to be frozen, it should be in a freezer at minus 18 or lower. And the idea being is that the bacteria at this low level at the bottom, it's basically too cold for it to do anything. All right, so when it's in a freezer, it's too cold, it can't do anything at all. If it's in a fridge, it's too cold for it to multiply at dangerous levels, but it still will eventually go off, and you've probably all seen milk that eventually goes lumpy. All right, so in terms of bacteria and how it kind of interacts with heat, a really hot temperature is going to kill bacteria. Somewhere in the middle is bacteria loves it, so we want to keep it away from that at all costs. And right down at the bottom, a fridge temperature slows down the bacteria growth, whereas a freezer will stop it altogether, but it only lies dormant. As soon as that food becomes then warm again, the bacteria will start to grow. And an example of this is a chicken that's been thawed out. Okay, so other things that we want to think about in terms of making sure that food is hygienic are things like sealed containers, using separate tongs and utensils for different foods. We want to make sure that food is being covered, keeping raw and cooked separate. We want to have things like the raw foods at the bottom of a fridge, cooked at the top. And again, you should have covered this in depth and in detail and should have lots of notes on this in your book. The last form of hygiene is kitchen hygiene, as you all know. And kitchen hygiene refers to how clean the premises are. So it's all the rules that we go through to make sure we're clean and tidy. So it's things like emptying bins regularly, first in, first out within the food storage systems, using best before dates and use by dates, making sure that you clean down regularly, you sanitize surfaces, and just ensuring that your whole general premises is really clean and tidy and therefore will not attract things like pests, mice, rats. Okay, when you have the time then, have a look at the pages on 18 and 19. All of the questions so far will be in Chapter 2 of the revision PowerPoint, where you've got the PowerPoint squares. Okay, so have a go within Section 2 and the questions on there. Obviously, the food hygiene chapter is a big chapter, and it's really significant in terms of knowledge for the exam. So you want to make sure that this is a chapter that you know really well. Okay, we're going to move on to page 20. Page 20 and 21 looks at general health and safety rules, all right? And it's a good thing to do to go through this and just to make some basic revision cards, all right, based on the key areas that it covers. Your first area, the Health and Safety at Work Act, you kind of need to learn this in conjunction with the Food Safety Act. Right, this is about protecting the people at work. So remember, food safety was protecting customers. Health and safety at work is protecting the employees. All right. So this is things like making sure that people are well trained, making sure they know about safety equipment, where, for example, a fire extinguisher might be, where the first aid kit is. And it's also making sure that from a health and safety perspective that the staff are all safe. So, for example, if there's a leak on the floor, we put out a sign. Okay, now the health and safety signs you can see at the base of page 20, you need to learn these. These are the kind of questions you might get as a one-point question at the beginning of the exam. What does this sign mean? So just have a look through those and make sure you know them. Okay, on page 21, you've got four different pieces of equipment. And within each one, you've got some basic rules that should be adhered to in order for the safe use of that piece of equipment. Again, have a look through these, fairly basic stuff, but make sure you have a really good read of deep fat fryers. It's a very popular question from exam boards. You need to make sure that you know that one. Okay, moving on to page 22 and 23. These are just some of the other key areas of health and safety. Again, this is fairly basic information. This isn't as complicated and there's not as detailed as the food, personal and kitchen hygiene elements or the information about the EHO. That's the key stuff from the chapter. But again, within these two pages, you've got lots of short format questions. So there's a high potential that you'll get asked small questions based on the content here. Now, very, very popular are questions about fires. What would we do if there was a fire? So make sure you read that content. And it's basically thinking about the same sorts of procedures that we go through at school. Listening to the bells, going to an established meeting place, not trying to put the fire out yourself, contacting the fire brigade. If a fire is small, however, though, it might be using things like a fire blanket or using a fire extinguisher to put something out early. But things like regularly testing fire alarms is another key thing that you would want to make sure you put down. Okay, now in terms of then fire procedures, I want you to think about if a fire happened at school, what would you do within your normal classroom? You turn off your oven, you take all of the electrical things, you turn them off, you turn off the gas to make sure that there was no future potential for things to escalate. You then close doors, you lock doors, you close windows to make sure no air can get in. You then go to an established meeting place that's far away from the fire before obviously contacting the fire brigade. Now at school we do fire drills as well, and again, bit of common sense, use that within your answer. Okay, on page 23, it's just got some basic things here about what to do if you actually have some form of an injury, all right? Now, again, a lot of this is common sense. Make sure you read the information about cuts, burns, and scalds. Again, this is a very popular short format question within the exam, so you would be well advised to read both of those components. Okay, now again, on page 24 and 25, if you want to pause the CD now or pause your iPod and just have a go at these questions, again, all the content we've looked at so far within this chapter is in section 2 on the revision squares. So feel free to stop now and have a look and test yourself using some of the questions provided. Right, the last part of chapter 2, pages 26 and 27, this needs to be something that you spend a really decent amount of time reading. If you get a question on risk assessment, or HACCP, this is likely to be a fairly big question worth lots of points. So you need to understand not just what HACCP is, but you need a good understanding of the process that you would go through. Because basically in an exam, you'd probably be given a recipe or given a scenario in which you would actually have to carry out a HACCP. So be very, very careful in how you approach this and make sure you have a good understanding about the process, what to do, and how to apply it to different recipes. Okay, so the idea behind risk assessment is ultimately to identify what could go wrong, figure out who might be harmed, how we can reduce those risks, and then how we can then review them and put things in place to stop those things from potentially happening, okay? And HACCP, if you like, is our kind of hazard analysis, critical control points. This is our way, as a food catering industry, we can try and stop certain things from happening, okay? Now, by law, we have to have these in food catering establishments, all right? And even the school has got health and safety reports that we have to stick to, all right? And the idea being behind a HACCP is that because we're identifying what could go wrong, we are stopping the potential for that thing from happening, all right? So because we understand that chicken might be a problem, we're making sure that we check that it's within date before we use it. Because we also recognize that the fridge temperature therefore might be significant, we're going to record that fridge temperature every day. And if therefore there's a problem with the fridge, we can identify that early, we can remedy the problem. If you look at page 27, there's lots of really good examples on here that go through the different things that you might look at within a HACCP, okay? Now, what it's not related to on page 27 is an actual dish, and the chances are in the exam, you would actually relate it to a dish, something like chicken curry, spaghetti bolognese, something with a meat or egg-based product within it, all right? So what you would need to do is you'd need to take the ideas from this table in terms of the hazards, and then what you would do, your hazard prevention, your critical control points, and you would need to actually be able to then transfer that theory onto a recipe. Okay, so notice the first step, buying and receiving food. Food could be contaminated with bacteria, especially high-risk foods. All right. So, for example, if we think about chicken, if chicken's not been stored properly, or if chicken, a raw chicken's been next to a cooked chicken, the food straight away could be contaminated. So, the hazard prevention or the critical control point would be making sure we buy it from a reputable supplier, and obviously checking the quality of the food before accepting the stock into our kitchen. We'd obviously want to make sure that the temperature of the van is correct that's been delivering the chicken, and obviously that the chicken itself is in use by date. So all I've done there is I've taken raw chicken and used it as an example within the answers they've already provided. What I want you to do, guys, is when you're revising HACCP, I actually want you to maybe draw out a table for yourself. All right. Think about a potential recipe like chicken curry or spaghetti bolognese, and identify what hazards there would be at all the different stages. And then for the hazard prevention, your critical control points, identify what you would do to stop that hazard from becoming a problem and potentially causing food poisoning to your customer. Okay, now you've actually got there on page 29 an example of what I've just been talking about, all right? So go through, have a look at that, complete the table, have a really good practice of it. If you still come out of it and not sure, show it to your teacher and they'll give you some good ideas for how to improve it. And again, from the whole of chapter 2, please use the revision squares that will just identify exactly lots and lots of different questions that might well be in the exam covering this particular topic.